KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Bayview.
Outer Sunset.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we'll hear about a mother and son who lost their housing in Oakland and what that means for his education.
I want them to keep the same friends and associates at the school as long as he can.
Then we talk about how white people can truly be allies to people of color, what works and what doesn't.
A lot of times we can be committed and yet we're still bringing our white privilege with us and it's splashing all over all the people we're working with.
And a revolutionary poet keeps San Francisco's literary fires burning with the release of his new book.
Special species of handshake, let's all know who's king and what's the lifespan of the uniform cough. This coffin needs to quit acting like those of birds singing.
Today on an extended edition of Cross Currents. Stay with us. Across the country, there are about 1.3 million homeless kids in our schools. The greatest number live in California. And research shows that not having a fixed address really impacts how students fare in the classroom. A little-known federal law called the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act is tailored to helping those kids succeed. This year, the law got even stronger. But the bad news is, in many districts, it's been chronically underfunded from the get-go. So many families and youth have no idea what their rights are. The Oakland Unified School District has seen a huge increase in its homeless students over the last year. But the district is also in the midst of a major budget crisis, and funding for homeless kids is not expected to grow. KALW's education reporter Lee Romney introduces us to one family that could use the help.
Nassim Bennett is getting ready for his first day of fifth grade. He can't find his bubblegum toothpaste, so he has to use the adult stuff.
That really stings the mouth.
It sounds like a typical domestic scene, but this isn't Nassim's house. He and his mom, Raquel Allenby, sleep in his great-grandmother's living room.
Is your grandma sleeping?
Yeah, she's sleeping.
Okay. Yeah, so I figured you guys have to be kind of quiet.
Yeah.
In the morning.
Yeah.
Is this where you sleep?
This is where I sleep, and he sleeps in the
air. Oh, okay. And then you put everything away in the morning, or?
Got to.
This is for today.
And they get up really early. It's 6 a.m., but Nassim's 22 miles and three counties away from his school. For years, Raquel and Nassim lived in North Oakland with Nassim's two sisters, Mr. Spooky the cat, and Cujo the chihuahua. Last fall, they got evicted from their Oakland apartment, Raquel says wrongfully. It's hard for her to use the word, but they became homeless.
Nassim is the main one that I worry about because I know when he's stressed out.
There's a lot of research that concludes students who lose their housing, even briefly, perform more poorly in school. They're often late or miss days. They're less likely than any other group to graduate. Nassim's had anxiety attacks, temper tantrums, and lots of stress eating. Early this year, he and his mom had no choice but to come here, to his great-grandma's one-bedroom apartment near a leafy park in South San Francisco.
And traveling from here all the way to Oakland, and then go Oakland, and then back here.
The back and forth, that's so Nassim can stay in the same Oakland school where he's been since kindergarten, where they know him and care about him.
Where are my Pokemon cards?
Are you serious?
Yes, I'm serious.
You cannot bring me to school, honey.
It's only 6:30 in the morning, but Nassim loads up his backpack.
All right, so we gotta start on carrying. Let me get my card.
Pops, you need your jacket.
I always forget that.
Pops. That's one of Raquel's nicknames for her son. He grabs his beat-up scooter with the busted handlebars to get to the BART station, more than a mile away.
She's not bad.
Neither she's not good.
The whole trip to school will take nearly 2 hours. They take a jogger's path to the station, teasing and goofing along the way.
What is the name of the vegetable kung fu master?
Broccoli!
His broccoli.
Raquel is a mom who knows how to prioritize her kids' education. Her oldest daughter is at UC Berkeley. She's got big hopes for Nassim, too, which is why she wants him to have some continuity at school, even though they're homeless right now.
I don't want to be, like, integrate Mehmet Nassim into the schools here, and then we got to transfer again. I want them to keep the same friends and associates at the school as long as he can.
Keeping Nassim in the same school, it turns out that's actually Raquel's legal right. 3 decades ago, President Ronald Reagan signed the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act into federal law. The big picture idea? To provide stability. The law guarantees that kids who have lost their fixed housing can stay at the school they've been attending. It guarantees other rights, too, like help with transportation costs to and from school. Raquel and Nassim could really use that.
What's this say, 340? Does it have B on it?
When Raquel and Nassim get to BART, it's time for an uncomfortable ritual. Raquel asks Nassim to run through the emergency gate.
And you go through the emergency.
Come on.
I keep saying that's the last time.
But it's never the last time.
It costs, like I said, it costs $400 a month.
Nassim's situation is not unusual. Last year, the Oakland Unified School District saw an increase of more than 50% in its homeless student tally, almost 1,600 kids. And those are just the families the district knows about. This is Trish Anderson, the district's new McKinney-Vento liaison. She just took over this fall.
When you think about the number of people in that situation in Oakland right now with the housing crisis, that number is bound to be larger than it was in the past, in previous years.
The law says districts have to work with school sites to identify students who've lost their housing. They're supposed to spread the word at soup kitchens and shelters and motels and laundromats so families know what they're entitled to, staying in their home school, enrolling without proof of an address, getting transportation help, and additional supports like school supplies and clothes, referrals to dental care, housing, and other services. But there's a big gap between what the law promises and what it delivers. Oakland Unified's Trish Anderson is just one person with a caseload of 1,600. The district's funding? It's stayed flat for the past 3 years. And it's not projected to grow this year. And Oakland hasn't gotten additional money for homeless kids from the state since 2011.
So you're having to serve more families with less
money. Yes.
Here at Emerson Elementary School, it's clear Nassim has deep bonds.
It's a trading card game. Hi, Miss Brooke.
Hi, good morning.
All right.
Is Miss B here?
Nope.
Do you know?
I haven't seen her.
She retired.
Some members of the school team figured out that Nassim lost his housing last year when he started showing up late. They offered him counseling, and a coach gave Nassim some clothes and a new Xbox since he lost a lot of stuff in the eviction. But even at schools that are doing a lot to help homeless students, many school employees aren't that familiar with the McKinney-Vento law. Principal Heather Palin.
I wouldn't say necessarily that there's a lot of training, but most people here have been doing this work long enough and understand the signs pretty quickly.
That lack of training, it's a problem. The principal couldn't talk about the specifics of Nassim's case for privacy reasons. But it turns out the school didn't report him as homeless to the McKinney-Vento office last year. Cases like this mean that Oakland's numbers aren't accurate. That can affect funding. More importantly, it means no one really spelled out for Raquel her rights under federal law or the services that the district can provide. Starting this year, the state's lone McKinney-Vento coordinator is supposed to step up training for district liaisons like Trish Anderson. In turn, Trish is required to make sure school site personnel, from principals on down, get trained in the law too, so that these kids are flagged and plugged into supports. Meanwhile, every single school district in the country will have to publicly report achievement, suspension, and graduation rates for homeless students to shine a brighter light on how they're doing and whether they're getting the support they need. But right now, plenty fall through the cracks. Parents like Raquel are often too proud to admit their circumstances. And because they don't fully understand their rights, they're fearful, too, that their kids might be told they can't stay in their school. When Raquel enrolls Nassim, she puts her old Oakland address on the form, just to be safe. Nassim's been in high spirits all morning, but his mood starts to shift.
I feel like I just got spiked in the stomach for some reason.
In class, Nassim puts his head on his desk. His teacher, Miss Grill, leans down close to check in.
How are you doing, Nassim?
I don't know.
You don't know? Is today feeling a little hard, the first day back at school? You're hungry?
Nassim takes a pass on the yogurt and apple the school provides for breakfast. So Miss Grill reaches into her personal snack bag.
I have a banana. Would you like a banana? Yeah.
Oakland Unified's Trish Anderson tells me that that first week of school, her drop-in center was packed. She fixed it up with a donated sofa and comfortable chairs, decorated the walls, and got to work writing letters to tap the private sector for help.
We're trying to coordinate something with My Red Shoes. It's a nonprofit agency that will provide shoes and maybe a gift card for uniforms and clothing for back to school. Feed the Children sends us our backpacks. There was an organization, Cata College, that offered the school supplies. Oh, don't think I haven't thought about approaching Uber or Lyft, right? The transportation, the new transportation experts to ask about donations from them. I'm on it.
Asking the community to pitch in, that's the best hope for many districts to even come close to complying with the revamped McKinney-Vento law. Trish arranged to have AC Transit bus passes dropped off at school for Nassim and Raquel, since Raquel works full-time as a janitor now and can't get to the drop-in center. It turns out that other than salaries and overhead, the entire district budget for homeless students goes towards those bus passes and doesn't even cover that need.
Around April, we're running out of funding for transportation.
As for help with BART, Nassim and Raquel are on their own. By the time Nassim gets back to his great-grandmother's house in South San Francisco, he and his mom are exhausted. It's almost 8 p.m. They've been out of the house for nearly 14 hours. Raquel worries that Nassim's not getting enough sleep to focus in school. And there's trauma that's harder to see.
When we lost our home, Nassim lost his peace and quiet, his privacy, our pets. So it was just really hard for him. I don't think he will ever feel comfortable at someone else's house because it's not his.
Raquel loves to dream about the home she'll share with her son again one day. But Nassim doesn't want to play that game.
Do you want your own room again one day?
Yeah.
What do you miss about that? You don't want to say, huh?
Raquel thinks Nassim just can't go there right now, that he's not confident he'll ever have his own space. I'm Lee Romney for Cross Currents.
If you've got an education story you'd like to see reported, email Lee at education@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Over the past couple of years, there have been many conversations about allyship, how people can support one another in their struggles, especially white people, and what role they could or should play in supporting people of color on issues related to discrimination, police violence, or marginalization. But sometimes that conversation can be complicated, and people are not clear about what the boundaries are to being involved. Well-meaning people may end up offending others. That's where Rahula Janowski comes in. She's part of Catalyst Project in San Francisco, and she's worked for years training people on how to be effective and respectful allies. She joins me in studio.
What is the Catalyst Project?
The Catalyst Project is an organization that seeks to build movements towards collective liberation through supporting people of color-led organizations and movements and working with white people in that movement to help build their anti-racism. We do that in a variety of ways. We do trainings. We do direct support for organizations of primarily white folks who are doing social justice work to help develop anti-racist practices and analysis and skills.
Mm.
Yeah.
What does collective liberation mean?
Collective liberation is a term initially coined by bell hooks, and it essentially means that we don't get there unless we all get there together, that all of the different struggles against oppression and against systems of power are linked and tied together. And so we're not just looking for an end to racism, we're also looking for an end to sexism and an end to ableism and basically towards a world where we all get to be our full selves and, you know, have access to the world.
Hmm. And you work with primarily white people?
Well, not exactly. We do training and, you know, developmental support primarily with white folks, but we also do a lot of work in solidarity with organizations led by people of color in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of trainings are they?
Well, we have a one-day training that's called Anti-Racism for Collective Liberation, where we take folks through what the history of white supremacy in the United States is. And when we're talking about white supremacy, we're not just talking about the white supremacists, you know, like the Nazis and the alt-right and those folks. We're talking about a system that's been in place since the founding of this country. And so we take folks through things like, I mean, one example that sometimes folks don't know about is the GI Bill, which helped bring a lot of people from like the working class to the middle class, was only available to white soldiers.
Hmm.
So that lifted white families and white communities out of like into the middle class, but it wasn't available to people of color who'd served in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many examples like that. And then we go through like how that lands on those of us who are white, how we get kind of cultured and trained to think and act in certain ways, and how that plays out when we step into social justice work, particularly when we step into social justice work with people of color. And then we talk about some of the skills and ways that you work with that as a white person trying to do good. Yeah.
So somebody who is white comes to your training and starts to learn about the history they don't know about, the realities they don't know about. What are some of the reactions that you've heard?
Well, it can be pretty intense for people.
Hmm.
You know, we do a piece where we ask folks, you know, to share, like, what do you know of the history of land theft in this country? And we all know a little bit about things, but when we put it all together, it's this really, it's kind of a devastating picture. And I think for some folks to really look at, you know, for those of us who are white, like, we've benefited from all of these systems, even though we, you know, most of us haven't had a direct hand in it. And I think that can be really heavy for some people. But we're really interested in, we want people to recognize that reality and grapple with it. And we also want people to be motivated by it, not disabled by it.
Hmm.
So we don't want people to go into shame spirals and be like, oh God, it's all so terrible. Like, yes, it is terrible. And we have a role to play in changing it.
Because that can happen, the shame spirals?
Sure. I mean, I think we put a lot of thought and practice into making sure that's not what people leave our work with. But it's definitely out there. I think that definitely sometimes folks are like, it's too much. I can't grapple with that, so I'm just going to step aside. And we don't want people to step aside.
Hmm. What's the difference between the person who leaves and the person who stays? How do you convince them? Like, what do you say?
Oh, well, you know, with our work, usually when people come to Catalyst, like come to a training, or we also have like a longer in-depth training that's like a 4-month process. And usually when people come,
that's quite a commitment.
It is a big commitment, yeah. So folks are already committed.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when folks come to even the one-day training, they already are committed to anti-racism. And really, for white folks, a lot of times we can be committed, and yet we're still bringing our white privilege with us, and it's splashing all over all the people we're working with. And so showing up committed doesn't mean that you actually know how to do it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking on your website. There's this photo of a man holding up a sign that says, white people, what will we do to change our legacy of violence? And another one, like a quote from your website, what would be possible if masses of white people resisted racism alongside people of color? And I want to talk about that alongside this conversation about being an ally,
yeah,
and allyship. What does it look like?
So when I think about allyship, I think about solidarity. which is the idea that what happens to you impacts me. And it does tie in with the collective liberation idea again, too, that our futures are all bound up in each other and our struggles are bound up in each other. And that as someone with a certain amount of privilege, it's kind of my responsibility, like that piece about like what will we do to end the legacy of violence? Like we have benefited from it, so we have an extra responsibility, I think, to respond to it and work to change things. And so being an ally, it means like standing in solidarity with people, recognizing that your liberation is tied up in their liberation, but also also there's an important piece there for folks showing up with privilege to look to the leadership of the most of the people most impacted by the system of oppression that you're looking at. So being an ally isn't showing up and being like, here's what we should do. Being an ally is showing up and being like, what can I do? How can I be helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who can be an ally? What is the criteria, if anything? Like, is it anybody?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I think anyone can be an ally. I think the important thing to remember, though, is that ally is not an identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's an action.
It's a verb.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not really a verb, but it's a verb.
Exactly. We talk about it like it's a noun, but uh-huh. but the practice of being an ally is to do things. And so I think anybody who, you know, who wants to support people's struggles and wants to, like, lend their support, whatever that looks like, to other people's struggles and to see that link and to know that that their liberation depends on that. That's, you know, so it's not something only white people can do. It's not something only straight people can do. It's something that we all can do. I think that the more privileges you have, the more of a responsibility you have to step into that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want us to hear this clip. There are, like I said, there's a lot of people talking about allyship, a lot of people of color, about how to do it right, mm-hmm. what to do, what not to do, what to say, what not to say. This is a clip by media personality Francesca Ramsey, 5 tips on how to be an ally.
Understand your privilege. Now, a lot of people get hung up on the word privilege, so let me break it down for you nice and easy. Privilege does not mean that you are rich, that you've had an easy life. All it means is that there are some things in life that you will not experience or ever have to think about just because of who you are. An ally's job is to support. You want to make sure that you use your privilege and your voice to educate others, but make sure to do it in such a way that does not speak over the community members that you're trying to support or take credit for things that they are already saying. This isn't Mario Kart. Stay in your
So she says things like, you know your privilege, stay in your lane. She says, if you imagine yourself as Destiny's Child, you are not Beyonce, you are Michelle. You can't be the lead singer in the group. Do you agree with these? And at the same time, are there more, like some basic principles, some basic things of, you know, mm-hmm. how to be a successful ally and respectful
mm-hmm.
of the oppressed or marginalized group as well?
Yeah. Well, I love Francesca's points. She's great. I definitely, that point about know your privilege is key. Because without being aware of the privilege that we're walking in and carrying with us, we can do a lot of harm. Like one of the things that I think is key for being an ally is to remember that impact matters more than intent. And so if you're stepping into a situation to help, and because you're not being conscious of how your privilege is playing out in your interactions with people, if you end up causing harm to somebody, it doesn't matter that your intentions were good. It matters for you, but it doesn't matter as far as the outcome. And so for folks who are working in solidarity, who are being allies, being aware of that, and if you do harm when you mean to do well, to take responsibility and not fall into like, well, but I meant something else, but to actually figure out how to address the harm, ask what happened, ask how you can fix it, and then take those steps. And then a really key thing is to keep moving. You know, I talked before about like not going into shame spirals. Sometimes when you make a mistake, like, and it's a mistake that's based on your internalized racism or like the way your privilege is playing out, it can feel, I think a really easy way is to sort of flounce, is to be like, well, I'm not needed here, and to sort of just remove yourself from the situation rather than deal with the pain that comes along with being accountable. But accountability is another one of the key things about being an ally, is actually you are accountable to the people who you are seeking to be in solidarity with, which means if they say, actually, what you're doing is not what we need, and you're sure that's what they need, it doesn't matter that you're sure. What matters is what they're asking for.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say that you're going to do something, you follow through on it. And if you mess up, you make amends and then continue to build relationship.
Does solidarity and allyship mean I show up at the rallies, I show up at the protests with my signs, I'm on social media, I say the right things? Is that all? Or because there's this other argument that are you an ally, like a political ally, when it's time to show up, you're there? Or are you, you know, do you have personal relationships with people of color? Do you have one-on-one daily interactions with people of color? Do you have friends or family? You know, there's a difference between the two. Is it, which is it? Or is it both?
I think it's both. I think it's both, and it's probably a lot more than that. One thing that I try to keep in mind is that there's so many factors that impact what we can and can't do. Like people with small children have less capacity to get out there and go to protests and maybe mostly engaging in personal conversations or online conversations. Other people have a lot more capacity to get out and do stuff. And so that's always good to remember. And then I think relationships are key. If you don't have relationships, you can't have accountability. So as organizations, like Catalyst is very pro-organization. We think it's a great place to do work from is if you're in an organization, because an organization helps keep you accountable. Mm-hmm. And also organizations can have relationships with other organizations and have accountability relationships there. And so that's part of what we do. We have relationships with a lot of organizations to whom we, you know, we're in relationship. And so there's accountability. There's, you know, a lot of exchange of ideas and leadership.
Is it challenging? What's challenging about those relationships?
I think that what's challenging? I mean, honestly, right now things are so challenging just because the environment we're in, that some of the stuff that in other times might be challenging, like interpersonal kind of stuff, feels really less important right now because the stakes are so high. There's so much happening right now, like so many gains that have been made being rolled back, so many direct attacks on so many of the communities that we are part of or allied with or in solidarity with, people that we love, that my ideal right now is that the places that are challenging interpersonally or interorganizationally are sort of like downgraded in terms of how much attention they get, because we really need to be together right now.
I have this question. Back home in Sudan and in African communities here as well, there is a mistrust of the British man, right? Just like the white man who came and colonized our land and killed us and took all our resources and left. And there's this feeling that I get sometimes, it's just like, we will never trust a British person. Until this day, if somebody gets married to somebody who's British, you know, the grandmothers and the grandparents are kind of like, you know, just like, she married, you know, the colonizer. And so I'm wondering, do you ever get a reaction which is, I can't trust a white person? I cannot trust white people. And what do you say to that?
Well, I think it's reasonable. I mean, those histories that you're talking about, they're not over. You know, the impacts of colonization is still playing out. Amends haven't been made. Reparations haven't been made. So if someone doesn't trust white people, to me, that feels like understandable. And I also don't take it personally because I'm not every white person.
That's
like, I'm not
hard, though. I mean, is it hard to hear and to know that people don't trust you because you're white?
It's not. I have a practice of learning not to take things personally because I'm a parent. so maybe that helps.
Yes.
But no, because I get it. I don't, I mean, I have, you know, you don't ever want to like compare different sets of oppression as though they're the same. But as a woman, I have some reasons not to trust men. You know, and I have plenty of healthy, vital, important relationships with men. And also, like, I don't automatically trust men. And I know that that's not about any individual. It's about the systems of oppression and about history and all these interlocking things. And so if someone doesn't trust me because I'm a white person, that has nothing to do with me, Rahula, who I am. It has to do with history. And again, like I said, that ongoing history. Colonization is still happening, you know, and the impacts of colonization are still landing on people's bodies.
And slavery and Jim Crow.
Yes. And so you know, I mean, it seems perfectly reasonable to me. And then for people who can trust white people, like, I think that that comes from, like, showing up, being accountable, being responsive to relationships, and again, not being personally insulted when someone has been impacted by systems of oppression and it has impacted how they view you, a white person.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic that enough people will eventually see what you see?
I tend to be optimistic, yeah. I kind of think that humanity is infinitely creative. I actually was having this conversation with my daughter recently about climate change, mm-hmm. where she's like, you know, there's no hope, which is not what you want to hear from a teenager. Mm. Like, actually, we haven't started trying yet. You know, like, we, like, the massive bulk of our resources are not towards addressing climate change, are not towards addressing systemic inequalities and systemic power oppression. And so I do have hope that if we can flip the balance to where we actually start trying to do that, we can do it. It's just the struggle to get to the point where we flip the balance is a long slog. And it's been going on for hundreds of years, and I'm not sure how much longer. But yeah, I think that there is, I don't know how far in the future.
Because you have a child?
Yeah.
Are you optimistic that her generation will be in a much, much better place than we are right now?
You know,
does it look like that? Does it sound like that?
Before the election, I would have said an unequivocal yes, because the kids are amazing. You know, she's in high school, and, like, she and her friends, like, understand terms that I didn't learn until I was in my 30s, like terms like, you know, white privilege or like all kinds of, they're like so gender expansive, and they're so just kind of like, they have this very like egalitarian approach and a very like all identities are valid kind mm-hmm. of approach that's really sweet. And I'm sure it's not universal. We are in San Francisco, but it gives me a lot of hope that, oh, if you are raised with the idea that, like, you can push back against systems of oppression and you should push back against systems of oppression, that changes how you move in the world.
And do you think they're more aware of their privilege and that it will therefore be easier for them to connect with people of color and be in solidarity?
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the Black Lives Matter movement has really, because it's been so successful and so widely known, like, there aren't, at least in my daughter's school, there's not teenagers who don't know what BLM stands for. She was actually wearing a Black Lives Matter shirt to school today. And like, people know what that's about. And they have conversations about it. And there's definitely some kids with the All Lives Matter line. But they're having those conversations. Mm-hmm. In a majority white, it's a multiracial, but it's still a majority white high school. They're talking about these things. And that gives me hope, you know, that they're already having those conversations. You know, and that they're talking about whiteness. The white kids are talking about, like, whiteness as a thing instead of, like, not even seeing it. And that's also hopeful.
So this has been great. I want to pretend like we're in one of your training sessions. Mm-hmm. And if you can just give me a little lesson. I don't know what.
Oh, jeez.
Pretend I'm a white person. And what's the first thing? Welcome to the training. Welcome to Catalyst Project.
That's really funny, because the first thing we do.
Throw your white privilege out the window. Like, what do you do?
Well, the first thing we do is we talk about the culture we create. Because when you're in a day together or 4 days together or whatever it is, you set up group agreements and you set up like guidelines for how you're going to treat each other in the room. Mm. And that's a great opportunity to look at the ways that if we don't do that, then we just default to the dominant structure, which is like white guys do the most speaking. People with college educations get to say the most and, you know, get heard the most. And we default to the dominant oppressive systems unless we take an active step not to. Mm. And so just by setting our group agreements for how we're going to be in the space, we're talking about sexism, we're talking about ableism, we're talking about white supremacy.
From the get-go.
Right from the get.
Okay.
And it permeates into everything. So every exercise is like that. It's not always a, this is white supremacy, but it also is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Rahula Janowski is an allyship trainer at Catalyst Project in San Francisco. Thank you. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hena Baba. People have come to associate writers like Mark Twain or beat poets like Allen Ginsberg with San Francisco. But that was then. What about today? KELW's Josiah Luis Alderete introduces us to one of the contemporary voices shaping the literary landscape of our city by the bay.
San Francisco loves its literature. Its literary roots go down deep into the concrete of neighborhoods like the Fillmore, La Mission, and North Beach. These San Francisco streets have incubated and nurtured the words of Maya Angelou, Alejandro Murguia, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And now, continuing this tradition, comes Tongo Eisen Martin.
The curtains remind alcoholics of church. Alcoholics remind the room that there is no revolution outside. The parking lot coughs travelers up through the late morning with bad land water on their face.
Tongo is a poet, activist, and educator. He grew up here in San Francisco, and his second book of poems, Heaven Is All Goodbyes, is being released this month by San Francisco's beloved publisher, City Lights Books.
Two news from a flight to a trench, a dust cloud of human form, mostly armed, flesh smoke, bored and nowhere, and nice time and nickel genocide.
Tongo is a literary force of nature. Go out any night of the week to a regular poetry event in the Bay Area, from the Amor for Alex Nieto benefit at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts last month, to Quiet Lightning's Poetry in the Park that happened last weekend, to Oakland's yearly literary Bacchanal the Beast Crawl, and chances are Tongo will be there.
You know, I'm really kind of just like a man with his instrument, and I will go play it anywhere for anybody who wants to hear it. You know what I mean? I just feel like a visitor, man, everywhere, you know what I mean? It's just, you know, you gotta invite the visitor in, though. Invite the visitor in, and I'll do my thing and be on my way.
Seeing Tongo read is an experience. When it's his turn, Tongo goes up alone. No notebooks, no iPhone screen to look at. His 6-foot-plus frame makes him stoop down into the microphone. Tongo will look at the audience, cock his head slightly and smile a thick-bearded smile. Then his words will just begin to spill out.
This dream requires more condemned Africans. Or put another way, state violence rises down. Or still life is just getting warmed up. Or army life is looking for a new church and ignored all other suggestions. Or...
And spill is exactly what I mean. It's a flow of words, a cascade of images. When Tongo recites, his poems tumble over and around you.
I've taken many a walk to the back of a bus that led on out the back of a storyteller's prison sentence, then on out the back of slave scars, but this is my comeback face. I left my watch on the public...
It's an elemental experience. You do not hear the poem so much as become surrounded by it. It can be discombobulating.
It flew through the bus line number, then on out the front of the White House. Hopefully you find comfort downtown, but if not, we brought you enough cigarette filters to make a decent winter coat. A special species of handshake lets all know who's king and what's the lifespan of the uniform clock.
The tempo doesn't stop as you catch your breath. All the while, his images continue to line up one behind the other. Their meanings flare in front of you, explode, and are replaced by another image that is equally profound and combustible.
So well with radio codes, or the way condemned Africans fought their way back to the ocean only to find waves made in 1920 burnt up piano parts you came back to.
The way in which he piles up image after image is this sort of surrealistic tornado.
Elaine Katzenberger has experienced many of Tongo's readings firsthand, and she edited Tongo's newest book. I spoke to her in the offices of City Lights Publishers above the famous bookstore in North Beach.
He brings you on these journeys, these visual journeys and emotional journeys that are really, really rich.
I've heard so many labels applied to Tongo. Slam poet, spoken word poet. I've even heard him referred to as a jazz poet, though that's a description Tongo feels uncomfortable with.
Jazz musicians, man, are like... alien samurai, you know what I mean? So to say, like, I think why I would leave jazz out of it is because jazz itself is such a martial art. mind and body and soul are truly one, you know. Poetry is just mind and soul. You know what I mean?
Labels aside, rhythm and music are strong elements in Tongo's work. Last week, he paired with Bay Area veteran poet-musician Avacha for an event called Bay Area Generations. And next month, the Poetry Center of San Francisco is hosting Tongo's performance with percussionist Marshall Trammell. And then there's his long-standing collaboration with Bay Area musician Chris Peck, a project called Lone.
A 1978 statement. Beagle and I are driving in an empty sail lane. We are God's evil to these settlers. They might throw us under the shift change. We take wolf naps. We don't know what else we good at besides this traveling.
Tongo was a poet from the very beginning. He says he wrote his first poem at the age of 5.
Some adult said it was good. And I remember this. Kids used to ask me, like, are you going to be a writer when you grow up? And that just sounded like the lamest thing ever, man. the lamest fortune you could get in Reaganomics, you know what I mean? In Reaganomic childhood. So I'd be like, no.
He might have tried to deny his talent, but his mother nurtured that aspect of him, and he grew strong, immersed in his culture.
My mother is, basically a 60s radical, you know, revolutionary. So I was kind of raised to know the real right from wrong.
She decorated their home with posters of Angolan women and African kings. She sent him to Meadows Livingstone, a small private Afrocentric elementary school in Potrero Hill.
Black culture was culture, you know what I mean? So black history was not black history class, it was history class. And we used to recite poems by, you know, Langston Hughes and these type of people. So it was always, you know, kind of like black culture was always strong, both, you know, literary and otherwise.
When he went off to Columbia University, he studied African American history in the day and attended poetry readings at the New Yorican Poets Cafe at night. And he took a course called Youth Voices on Lockdown.
And it was basically a class that brought the Columbia students into Rikers Island to work with the kids that were incarcerated there. And I ended up, you know, taking in, took responsibility for like the next, you know, for 5 years. But by the time I finished up college, I knew I had, you know, I kind of had these revolutionary principles, but the question was then, how do I apply them? How do I practice them? And it was in education, and I thought that was the place where I could do the most, the best work politicizing people.
During this time, his roles as activist, educator, and poet began to overlap and fall into each other. He taught at the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. Part of his job was to design social justice curricula that have been used everywhere from San Francisco to South Africa. Elaine says Tongo is both a political poet and a lyrical poet.
It's not just political poetry, and there's not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's not what he's giving us. But politics is all in there, and the deep connection and love for humans and humanity and a desire to see people realized.
That revolutionary aspect that Elaine talks about brings to mind another San Francisco poet, Bob Kaufman. He died in 1986, but here's a clip.
Egyptian mummies are lousy dancers. Alcoholics cannot make it on root beer. Jazz never made it back down the river. Licking postage stamps depletes the body fluids. Fat automobiles laugh more than others. Men who die in wars become seagulls and fly. Roaches have a rough time of it from birth. People who read are not happy. People who do not read are not happy.
Bob Kaufman was this person who did the same kind of things to you with his poetry. I mean, he just really presented a very clear and sometimes raw version of black experience in particular, and had an amazing gift for language.
City Lights also published Kaufman's poetry in its Pocket Poets series, the same series that is publishing Tongo's new book.
That Pocket Poet series is our signature series here at City Lights.
The series is responsible for publishing Allen Ginsberg's famous Howl, as well as local literary luminaries like Diane DePrima and Wanda Coleman. And now Tonga will be the 61st Pocket Poet.
The series is really meant for revolutionary poetry. And that can mean content or style or anything, really. So it's a pretty broad term that's applied. But when I was thinking of publishing Tongo, I just knew that that was the place to put him.
Book titles. Like, Hero, You'd Make a Better Zero. Or, Fur Coat Lady, The President is Dead. Or, Pay Me Back in Children. Or, They Hung Up Their Bodies in Their Own Museums. And other book titles, Pulled Out of a Drum Solo, Run Here, Hero, Lie at the Hiding Place, All the Bullets in 10 Precincts, Nowhere to Go, It's No Heaven nor Any Other Good Idea in the Sky. Politics means that people did it and people do it. Huh. Understand that when in San Francisco and other places that...
With the release of Tongo Eisen Martin's Heaven Is All Goodbyes by City Lights Books, San Francisco's literary tradition takes deeper root into the concrete and reaches even farther up to the sky. And I'm sure that if we could somehow look under the concrete, we could see under there the roots of one neighborhood connecting with the other one, one era of poetry connecting to the other, giving us a view of San Francisco that the lovers of literature around here can continue to recognize. For Cross Currents, yo soy Josiah Luis Aldavete.
The book release, celebration, and reading for Tongo Eisen Martin's Heaven Is All Goodbyes happens tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco.